Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Please be seated. We're back on record for our third and final hearing of the day at College of Southern Idaho, sitting as the Supreme Court today. And we are appreciative of, again, the accommodation of the college in allowing us to be here today. The matter before the court is entitled Salazar versus Salazar, case 50725. In this matter, the appellant is Erasmo Salazar, represented by Sally Cooley, with Ellen Salazar, the respondent, represented by Eric D. Nielsen. Counsel, anything preliminary before the argument today?
No, Your Honor.
Nothing.
Ms. Cooley, please.
May it please the court, counsel. This is an appeal from a criminal contempt trial and sentencing whereby the magistrate found Mr. Salazar in contempt for failure to comply with a divorce decree and imposed a jail sentence and probation. Mr. Salazar was not present for the contempt trial and sentencing, and he did not have counsel to represent him at either of these two hearings. Holding the proceedings in such a fashion violated Mr. Salazar's constitutional rights and the requirements of this court's Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75. Now, to initiate this action, Mrs. Salazar, the petitioner, filed a motion for contempt seeking jail time as punishment for Mr. Salazar's failures to do certain things ordered by the divorce decree, things such as paying attorney's fees, several bills, filing his tax return and indemnifying her, paying child support, and refinancing the mortgage. 2 months before the contempt trial, Mr. Salazar requested a public defender, but was found ineligible due to his income. He told the court he would hire an attorney, but no notice of appearance was filed. Now, about 10 days before the trial was set to occur, Mr. Salazar did attend a pretrial conference via Zoom. However, he was not present for his actual contempt trial. He notified the court clerk before the hearing started that he was stranded in Utah, his car had broken down, and he had no way back to Idaho. Now, the magistrate court held the criminal contempt trial in his absence and in the absence of counsel. Mr. Salazar was found guilty of all 9 counts of contempt. Not only did the trial occur without Mr. Salazar or counsel, but the sentencing disposition, the sanctions were imposed immediately following the trial, still in the absence of Mr. Salazar and counsel. Without counsel and without an opportunity to present witnesses or present mitigating information, Mr. Salazar was sentenced to 70 days of incarceration with 50 days suspended and placed on probation for an indefinite period of time. The order provided, a violation of the respondent's probation may result in the respondent serving his suspended jail time, fines, contempt, or other civil criminal sanctions as this court finds to be appropriate. Now, Mr. Salazar appealed to the district court, who found that he did not knowingly, intelligently, and waive his right to counsel for the hearings, and the district court vacated the jail sentence. The district court correctly determined that Mr. Salazar did not waive his right to counsel, but should have vacated both the contempt finding and the sentencing, where the magistrate court violated Mr. Salazar's constitutional rights and the procedures set forth by Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75 in holding these hearings in Mr. Salazar's absence as well as the absence of counsel. Now, in this case, the petition sought unconditional incarceration as a sanction, therefore it is a criminal sanction. A penalty is also unconditional, even if it is suspended and the condemner is placed on probation. So that's the situation here. He was placed on probation for these with those specified terms that I just read. Now, this court's decision in Camp v. East Fork Ditch Company explains the United States Supreme Court holdings that federal constitutional rights are applicable to non-summary contempt, criminal contempt proceedings. So here, we, in addition to the U.S. constitutional rights, we also have a court rule promulgated by this court, Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure, Section 75I, governs non-summary proceedings and requires trial rights required to impose a criminal sanction. The court cannot impose a criminal sanction unless the respondent was provided the following rights, and including the right to call and cross-examine witnesses, the right to testify in his or her behalf, and the right to counsel if applicable. And then, if contempt is found at this initial trial proceeding, The imposition of sanctions also has a separate section. That section is governed by 75L, and it requires a right to counsel. The court cannot impose sanctions unless the condemner was represented by counsel or had knowingly and voluntarily waived the right to counsel, and also requires the right to call witnesses and speak regarding the sanctions. The court cannot impose a criminal sanction without the right to be heard or to present matters in mitigation or to otherwise attempt to make amends with this court. And here what we have is a situation where the court did find that Mr. Salazar was voluntarily absent, and that finding has not been challenged on appeal below. But counsel did argue that a warrant of attachment was a proper mechanism here to get Mr. Salazar to court. Under subsection E of Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75, the discussion is of a warrant of attachment and bail. If there is probable cause to believe the respondent committed the contempt and there are reasonable grounds to believe the respondent will disregard a written notice of appear, then a warrant of attachment may be issued. And that was a proper procedure in this case, particularly where it was essentially an ex parte proceeding, an ex parte trial and sentencing, where there was no counsel on behalf of Mr. Salazar, and Mr. Salazar himself was not present, and he did not waive his right to counsel. If there are no questions at this point, we'd ask the remainder of our, reserve the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
I just want to clarify what you're arguing on appeal. Are you addressing both of what I think of as the legal holdings of the district court, which were, one, there was no violation of his right to be present, and two, there was a violation of his right to counsel. Are you arguing about the district court's conclusion that his right to be present wasn't violated?
Yes, Your Honor. It is our position that his right to present was violated as well as his right to have counsel. He did not waive his right to counsel, and he was not present. And here, where he had an excuse, the court ultimately found that it was not a legitimate excuse, but he had called in and notified that he was not able to be present. And I think that the provisions of Idaho's Rule of Civil Procedure 75 really lay out the rights here. And, as counsel argued below, I just don't know how the right to testify in his or her own behalf can be exercised or available if the respondent is not present in the courtroom at that time.
So and the is district, not. One of my questions is the district court concluded there was no need for a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of the right to be present. Is that a correct legal determination? But it was enough if he was willfully not present. He didn't have to provide a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of his right to be present.
Well, Your Honor, I think I don't know if the waiver must be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, but there must be some sort of affirmative waiver. I mean, this is a right we're talking about, and these rights that attach, the right to testify in his or her own behalf, are implicit in the Constitution. So I would say that under Hager, the right must be waived affirmatively and on the record, and not simply by an absence or omission, a failure to appear. Your Honor, I don't believe it does, and that is because the provisions of Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75 provide that the rules of civil procedures shall apply. And I know that was argued below, and that was a point made by the appointed public defender to the district court. But I, in my reading of that, it does not apply, and that's why we did not pursue that argument on appeal. I think I have the language here, or maybe not. But there is... The rules of civil procedure apply to contempt proceedings unless they specifically incorporate a criminal rule. But it's civil rules here, and there's not a like civil rule for Idaho Criminal Rule 43.
But it's the constitutional rights that apply.
Yes. Yes, the constitutional rights are what govern. And here, even with this court rule, we're still having the rights testifying his or her own behalf. And so here we have someone who was not present and was not notified that failure to appear will result in, a default, or you won't have any, giving up these constitutional rights if you don't appear. Under Haggard, if you're going to be giving up constitutional rights, you need to be informed of that and needs to be an affirmative waiver. And the presumption is against the waiver of constitutional rights.
So So the procedure to have a trial in absentia, which happens sometimes in a civil case, can never happen in a criminal case? Is that your position?
Well, Your Honor, this is a civil case, but with criminal penalties. You know, it's a sui generis. It's of its own making the contempt trial.
So in a contempt case, for criminal contempt, that can never proceed in absentia?
Your Honor, if the respondent or the contemnor, alleged contemnor, affirmatively waives that right, I think that can happen. But the knowledge must be there, and an affirmative waiver on the record, you know, with advisories on the rights that the contemnor is giving up. Yes, that I think that would be possible. Here, that did not happen. He called in and said he couldn't make it to court, and we ended up having a trial, an ex parte trial with no counsel and no client. No alleged contemnor. I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel.
This opened. I may need you to come off this report. Sorry.
It should be fine.
Okay. I filed a motion for contempt over some pretty emergent issues that were going on in Ellen's life in March of 2022. Those were time-sensitive issues. One was the fact that we were having the Idaho State Tax Commission come and garnish Ellen's wages. The other one was that her credit was being destroyed. If you think about where we're at now, that was March of 2022. We're almost 3 years removed from that. And that succeeded. Her credit is destroyed, and the Idaho State Tax Commission did come after her. And so this for us is a problem of time. You know, we were there in the contempt trying to get this done quickly. One of the problems that I ran into as a practitioner was he no-showed his arraignment. Mr. Salazar no-showed his arraignment. So I did issue wrongful arrest. And I arrested him, and we got him in, and then he was arraigned. And then I had had a totally separate unrelated issue in which this exact topic came up. And so when I showed up on June, at that June hearing, I told Judge Cannon, listen, we have to address his right to counsel because I'm asking for incarceration. And whatever that takes. And at that hearing, Mr. Salazar said, we went through the entire application for public defender on the record. And then he said, and he failed to qualify. And then he said he's going to hire Jennifer Doctor as his lawyer. And we ended the hearing. The problem with Mr. Salazar is he often doesn't show up to hearings. I've been the divorce attorney in this case since 2018. We have multiple attorney's fees judgments against him, all secured with the house, all secured on the house. And so he is willfully not getting rid of that house and not taking her name off of it because she stands to get that money. One of the things that I just don't know now is if during that hearing I had said instead, if during the actual trial date, when the trial happened and he, of course, we know just demonstrably that he lied about where he was, but had that morning instead, I had shown up and I had just said, we got to arrest him again. Then what? That's my problem. So then we get him there, he's arrested, we arraign him again, let him go, and then what? Because I've already done that once. And so when the district court says my solution to this problem is warrant, it's tough because if I get him there, I still don't have a voluntary waiver. He still doesn't have a lawyer, and he still doesn't qualify for public defender. And so I had a decision to make at that day where I just said, listen, he's been arraigned. It says in 75 that he has to have a lawyer for me to ask for incarceration. And Judge Cannon and I believe that we had crossed that threshold on the in our conversation on the record the morning of the trial. The thing that's very difficult for me in this case is that hearing in which we kind of went in detail over his right to counsel was that June 26th hearing that appears didn't make it into the record for the district court to review. And that was a frustrating element of the case just because it was that, as I said, this was an emergent sort of situation in which we deciding on June, in the June hearing to move it, to go through his constitutional rights to get an attorney was difficult for Ellen, especially since we were trying really hard to do this as quickly as possible. I still right now, as I sit here, don't know if I arrest him. I know in contempt proceedings and family law matters, courts don't just hold them until we have a trial. I'm gonna let him go. They're not gonna put a big bond up. I don't know how to get him to voluntarily waive his right.
Let's talk about that for a second, the bond. There was a time when he was required to post a surety bond.
Right.
How much was that?
Very little, I can't remember.
Is there a limit on how much the court can place?
I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, is it possible for the court to set a $10,000, $20,000 bond?
I think so. Yeah.
So would that have been a mechanism that could have been used here?
It's possible. I just, in any contempt trial I've ever done, I've never seen a magistrate get that committed to doing something to that degree. You know, that's my problem is I don't think Judge Cannon would.
Even under the outrageous facts that you've described behind the failure to appear, the difficulty in serving, giving all that, you don't think that...
Well, the decision that was made was that he would go serve 3 days and then be let loose and then serve on the weekends. And so one of the issues that I have is just I can't get magistrate judges to do that. There's just no way. And so
have you asked for a high bond, and especially with these facts?
No, I think this is the most outrageous set of facts I've ever had. So probably not. I just don't. I guess when I say that, I don't think they will. But I could be wrong about that. And maybe if the issue is one where it's very uncommon, this is a very uncommon scenario. Most of the time they do have a public defender, or at most of the time they qualify and we're on our way. But in this particular case, what's difficult is it appears that Mr. Salazar gets to choose if he's incarcerated or not. Because if he doesn't waive, and if he doesn't get an attorney, and he doesn't qualify for a public defender, and I can arrest him as many times as I want, but I still don't know as I stand here what I would do in my next case, where if this exact same set of circumstances were happening, if he were brought back in, he were arrested, and then can I get him to voluntarily waive his right to counsel so I can incarcerate him? Can I force that?
Was he given a Faretta warning at any point?
I'm sorry?
A Faretta advisory at any point?
I don't think he was given a specific Faretta warning at any point. I think what we always use in the arraignment process in all contempt actions is what he had multiple times. So that's the other issue is, if we're reading him his rights all the time, we've done this multiple times, what's the point in reading him these rights when if he just flakes on the trial and he exercised those rights terribly, and I have a client here who has urgent issues that needs to be heard, how do I help Ellen get into trial still?
Again, it just sounds like to me you had a compelling case for a high bond.
Yeah, and it could be that I just needed to say to the court, his bond needs to be astronomical. But it really is difficult in the family law world to go that far. You know, like for non-payment of child support, it's difficult to say, arrest him till the next trial setting. I guess if that's this court's decision, I'll do that.
Isn't fundamentally... And I appreciate where you're coming from as a practitioner, but isn't it fundamentally a problem that exists with certain debtors? It doesn't matter. In some instances, there is nothing that a judgment holder can do to effectively force payment? I mean, I think of O.J. Simpson, just putting it out in the sort of the general public's awareness. When you think of all the efforts that the Goldman family engaged in to try to get payment from O.J. Simpson, and I don't know if they, I don't know what they ever got. But my point being, in some instances, all the legal avenues all point to a fundamental problem of you can't squeeze blood from a turnip, you can't, and you're just not going to force the person to do what they've been ordered to do. And that's why the state has created laws where you can't, where they can go after somebody's driver's license, where they can go after professional licenses to force payment, right? I mean, isn't...
I think there are those situations, but I think that this situation is one where, especially one particular remedy, where he needed to unload the house, he needed to sell the house, was very doable. And there are rules after I get that order of contempt, there are rules where I can divest him, and I can go sell the house. And so, really, the ultimate solution for me was to get an order that he's going to sell the house. And if he fails to sell the house, I'm going to go into court and I'm going to divest him of that interest temporarily to sell it on my own.
But do you have to do that through the contempt proceeding?
No.
Right. But it strikes me as I'm listening to you, I mean, part of the answer, I think, is whether it's fair or not, is that when you're going to seek a criminal contempt sanction, you get up to speed on what is everything I think this guy could do to avoid this. Get up to speed on all of the rights, and when you're at the hearing, judge, let's give him Faretta warnings. Let's, you know, I mean, sometimes I think you have to be prepared to educate the judge about this is the history with this guy, and so let's give him all the warnings now. And then if he doesn't show up, you lay out your history, you seek the high bond, and I think that's the best you can do.
Well, I guess that's maybe the answer is that even in my order for advisement of rights, I have to put out all the threat warnings. But if I don't get him to voluntarily waive, like if even after all those warnings and all of that, if he shows up and he doesn't voluntarily waive, then and this was some of the case law that I cited, is behavior something that the court can address? Other than the bond, other than the warrant for arrest. Is there room in Idaho law where he would show up and the courts had enough and he said, we've arraigned you twice. You understand your rights. You obviously were partying in Utah during the trial. I know. I mean, Judge Cannon knows who this guy is. This isn't a mystery. Hey. And so can behavior and him just so, and I don't know, that's what I cited in my brief.
And that's where I'm saying, if you're going to seek a criminal sanction and you know this is who you're dealing with, I mean, I can't tell you what arguments would be successful and what the procedure is, but I think if, unfortunately, it's on you, but if you do some research into some of these issues in criminal law, you will find cases that talk about this was okay, that wasn't okay, and you just go and you're armed with those and you're prepared to kind of guide the judge in, let's do this all now so that if he doesn't show up, yeah. We've got our I's dotted and our T's crossed.
Well, I think that this is one of the struggles in the contempt world is, and that's what was addressed by the question from Justice Meyer, was are the criminal laws applicable, right? Well, and in contempt, where the criminal rules definitively don't apply, one of the difficulties is just this patchwork quilt of, okay, well then what does apply?
Right.
And you're left looking for like you're talking about aiding your, you know, your arguments with criminal law ideas.
Right.
But fundamentally speaking, does it apply? I don't know. It doesn't say it does.
Well, I think our criminal contempt case law is pretty clear that those constitutional rights do apply when you seek a criminal law sanction. So even if the criminal rules aren't applicable, the protections afforded to a contemnor, they do. exist.
And so I guess the one thing I would say then on this subject is to make the distinction between what happened in the courtroom criminally and what happened in the courtroom civilly. And some of those sanctions that are civil sanctions, I don't, and at least it's my understanding, we don't need to run through that. The civil sanction side of this contempt case is still completely fair game in his absence. And I can move forward in his absence and get civil sanctions without him there, without going through any of those types of rules, unless I'm seeking incarceration in which he needs an attorney. And so one of the issues...
Or an unconditional sanction. Right. I mean, that... Yeah, so it could be you have to pay X number of dollars and there's no way you can avoid it. That could also be a criminal sanction.
And so I think we have to be very careful in looking at the decision and making sure we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater as to there's elements of this decision that were civil and that should remain in place. Some of those, like, for example, the order that he needs to sell the house is just an absolute civil, that's just a civil remedy. Has nothing to do with incarceration. And so the order that he has to make this payment within 90 days, all of these things that went into place, these are civil sanctions and are all fair game for this order to remain intact. And I think that's what the district court did, was said, this incarceration stuff's going to go, everything else we can handle outside of his presence. And so if what the court's telling me today is that in the future I just have to keep arresting him, or if I have to arrest him and ask for that high bond, and that's my only remedy, it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one for people in her situation where I'm not a prosecutor, I don't have, she's paying, he's not, you know, there's not unlimited resources here, and so it puts people who are especially indigent or who just need relief in very expensive situations. And situations where we show up to arraignments more than once, like we did in this case. And so it makes it, when it's, no, seriously, you have to follow these rules. No, seriously, these are your constitutional rights. And then he continues to not come. It makes it really difficult to navigate after that for someone who, I mean, if you can think about where we are now 3 years later, trying to still just get him to sell the house and he won't.
Well, in these kind of cases, again, not every one of these type of defendants is going to react the same way to the same incentive, right?
Right.
There's going to be some that are more concerned about their pocketbook. There's going to be some that don't want to spend a day in jail. I remember when I was a law clerk, armed with nothing more than a limited license, I was helping my law firm do a collection. Guy didn't show up for a debtor's exam that I was going to conduct as a 2L. And when he didn't show up, my senior partner said, attach his body. I turned white. I'm sure my eyes got you. What? You can do that? He goes, oh, yeah. Go have the sheriff arrest him. I remember getting the phone call from the sheriff's office in Teton County saying, we have a very angry man in the prison here who wants to talk to you, and you want to talk to him. So I immediately had to make arrangements to get a court reporter there and conducted the most awkward debtor's exam I've ever conducted in my life. In the end, you know, he was a guy we just had to stay after, and we learned that the one thing he didn't like was being in jail.
Yeah, and I can't get this guy in jail. There's no way. Because if after this I say, hey, I want a warrant for his arrest, I have to rely on the magistrate to just say, and I need you to keep him incarcerated until the trial. And when he shows up for the trial, I need you to get him to voluntarily waive his rights to an attorney.
So, as the respondent in this case, you're not the one here asking for relief, but in light of the constitutional elements of this case, what are you asking us to do?
What I'm asking you to do is give some clarity as to what 75L1 means. Because if in that case, 75L1 says the court cannot impose incarceration as a sanction unless the contemnor was represented by counsel or knowingly and voluntarily waived the right to counsel. My question is there any possible way that knowingly and voluntarily waiving your right to counsel can be done by behavior? Because, and that's what I briefed, is because there's, I think there's some law in Idaho to suggest yes.
do we need to change the rules about incarceration and about bond, or are they sufficient?
No, they are not sufficient in the state for contempt actions. There's nowhere for me to go. It needs to at least allow me to, this leaves too much in the respondent's hands. He's controlling whether he, I guess I'll say it this way. I have another contempt trial coming up 2 weeks from now. Incarceration's on the line. Should I tell my client to fire me? Should I tell him to fire me and to go into court, tell him not to waive, not to get a public defender, and then you can't be incarcerated then? There's no way. No? Yeah, sure. You know, I guess they could arrest him, and then what? He's at his own hearing. He showed up for the trial. He went through the entire trial. And at the end, he'd say, never waived my right to an attorney, didn't get a public defender, didn't hire, you can't put me in jail. And I think that's an effective argument under what we have right now in 75 right now. And so, I mean, it kind of makes me question if that's how I should advise other people. Don't get a lawyer. If you're going to have a contempt action and you're thinking incarceration, getting lawyers. So that to me is like I'm still wrestling with, and I've kind of anecdotally surveyed other magistrates and said, what should I have done? You know, and it's always different. You know, I don't think there's a unified answer to the question among at least the ones that I've talked to. And so I think ultimately that's the question that I'm here to ask the court on. I probably wouldn't have appealed that issue if we didn't get appealed, but I think that's an important thing for this court to answer for us, is what should we do in that situation. The other major thing I just think the court needs to address is the judgment. The judgment decree of divorce, paragraph 30, says if either party has to bring an action to enforce the decree of divorce entered in this case, then this court shall award the prevailing party his or her attorney fees and costs. And I think when the district court didn't do that, at least partially or address it, I think that the district court needs to, knowing that it's Ellen who is trying to enforce a judgment decree of divorce, it's her that's trying to get relief, and in their judgment says if anyone's pursuing anything related to that, then those attorney's fees and costs are paid by the prevailing party. I think on the district court level, we prevailed at least in part. And if the court decides not to give for attorney's fees and costs, I still think that's an issue that needs to be addressed because they're mandatory. It's the word shall be awarded to the prevailing party. So other than those things, I have, you know, you can understand my concerns about the incomplete part of the record, but were the Feretta warnings read during that time? Did he voluntarily waive? I don't think so. I don't know if the Feretta warnings were read to him completely. I just still am at a loss as to how that's going to work. So unless the court has any other questions, that's all I really have.
Because there are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
20 minutes, Your Honor.
Very well. Ms. Cooley?
I would just like to discuss, I guess, possible remedies here based on the counsel's information and questions for the court. I do think that an option available to Mrs. Salazar would have been a civil contempt as a sanction. And that would include a situation where the contemnor has the keys to his own jail cell, where it's conditioned on him taking his name off the house in order to avoid a incarceration tendency. And I think that would have negated some of the issues that counsel has engaged in here. I think that the criminal contempt was the wrong way to go about it. I think that a civil contempt as a sanction would have been more appropriate to induce him to do these things that she sought to have him do. Because once you have a criminal contempt and incarceration that is non-conditional, then the rules apply. The United States Supreme Court due process rights attach. And so here, whereas a petitioner is seeking the contempt order to do specific acts, having a threat hanging over their head, where they hold the keys to alleviate this threat, would perhaps be a good inducement here.
And well, listening to what both of you are saying, it sounds like criminal contempt just really isn't a viable option in Idaho anymore. It's available, but it's illusory.
And Your Honor, I don't think that's accurate. I just think there are a lot of steps that need to be gone through to take away to imprison and put in jail my client, as in this case. And the magistrate courts, it seems, have power to incarcerate and have a high bond, as this court has been discussing. I think that would bring the contender before the court. But there are a lot of rights that attach when there is a criminal contempt sought. And here, Mr. Salazar did not get those rights.
Would there be any legal reason you're aware of why the court, if in its discretion, it decided to set a bond of $50,000 in a case like this?
Your Honor, bond can be argued by an appointed public defender or by the petitioner in that case, the respondent in that case. Mr. Salazar could have certainly argued that. If the court had the circumstances before it where it believed in its discretion that was appropriate, we can certainly argue against it as public defenders, it's the court's discretion. If the court has a wealth of information about that person's failures to appear, problems with process serving, some of the things that were present here, then perhaps that is justified. I don't practice in magistrate court. I don't know what normal bonds are, and $50,000 is an incredible bond. I think that having a higher bond or having this warrant of attachment and then having a hearing right away. The magistrate court has room on its calendar, hold that hearing right away and have the contender brought up. These are all available options. And I think here what the fault was the criminal contempt being sought, the unconditional jail time. And with that, the panoply of rights attaches and constitutional and under Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75. In response to Justice Meyer's earlier question, it is provision N that provides rules regarding discovery and other rules of civil procedure to the extent they are not in conflict with this rule apply to non-summary contempt proceedings. The Idaho criminal rules do not apply. So those are inapplicable in this circumstance. And, with regard to Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75, for the most part, these rules provide that the court cannot impose a criminal sanction without, this panoply of rights. And they specify a criminal sanction. I think that, a civil sanction would negate a lot of these requirements, in the interest of what the respondent needs to be doing in the future. As far as in this case, what happened with the district court seemed to be trying to convert the criminal sanctions into civil sanctions by taking away the jail time. However, that was ineffective. There's still probation. The language still says that violation of the probation, that language is not removed, may result in the respondent serving suspended jail time, fines, contempt, or other civil criminal act sanctions as this court finds to be appropriate. And so he still has potential fines. And if these fines are unconditional, they are therefore going to be criminal by nature. And with the civil contempt sanctions, only notice and an opportunity to be heard is what the United States Supreme Court has held and is mandated for civil conditions. And once again, that's because the contemner holds the keys to his jail. By doing certain things, he can alleviate jail time, he can alleviate potentially fines, things along those lines. And here, although this was not something that was brought up by the public defender appointed in magistrate court appealing to the district court, we do have a civil fine, and we don't have a finding that Mr. Salazar has the present ability to pay. So I do think there are additional things wrong here. With the civil contempt, there needs to be a finding by the court that the contender has the ability to pay, the present ability to pay, before that can be, ordered or or found. I guess in summary, in this case, Mr. Salazar's constitutional rights and his rights under Idaho Rule of Civil Procedure 75 were not abided by. They were violated by holding his contempt trial and the sentencing outside his presence in the presence of counsel. We would ask that the contempt finding and the sanctions be vacated. And this will start processing it.
Before you sit down, there hasn't been a lot of discussion about the cross appeal. I recognize a lot of the cross appeal is a reflection of the appeal itself, but there are a couple issues, including the attorney's fees issue and the failure to award them. Could you discuss that?
Certainly. The attorney's fees requested in this case were for the prevailing party because of the district court's decision regarding the lack of counsel and the lack of a waiver of the right to counsel. We would argue that Mrs. Salazar is not the prevailing party in this matter. That Mrs. Salazar has also alleged that the case was brought, pursued, or defended frivolously, unreasonably, or without foundation. I think that is meritless in this case. This is an issue. The fact that he was tried and sentenced to jail without counsel and without being present is a constitutional question. It certainly was not frivolous or unreasonable or without foundation. As a district court found, he had not waived his right to counsel. Vacated that, or and vacated the incarceration section. I think under Idaho Rules of Family Law Procedure 901 and 902, those are not available on appeal. They govern only the magistrate's division. Also, because in this court's decision in Able v. Able, I believe there was a decision that the attorney's fees were not to be determined because that. Individual, the petitioner was not the prevailing party at that point. And then contractual attorney's fees, I think I quoted in my brief, in other words, when the agreement is merged into a divorce decree, the right to enforce the contract through an action for breach of contract is supplanted by the divorce court's authority to enforce its orders. So I think this is a contempt action, not a breach of contract action. Today.
This does, though, come up in a divorce setting, and sometimes in a divorce setting we look at attorney's fees a little different. And here the attorney's fees being sought were primarily based on the language of the divorce decree. Counsel argues in his cross-appeal brief that they essentially prevailed on all but one issue. I would have to admit that was the major issue of the case, but they did prevail on the other issues. Is there any reason why they should have just been outright denied?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, do you mean outright denied?
Well, I mean, there was really no discussion, was there? The court ruled.
Regarding in the magistrate court?
Yeah, no, in the district court.
You're right, Your Honor, that is correct. The district court, I believe counsel for the respondent did file a motion requesting attorney's fees or make some argument at the actual, on appeal to the district court. And the district court did not address it at all, did not say one way or the other. And I think that implicitly is saying that there was no prevailing party here, because the high penalty was vacated, the jail sentence was vacated, but there was a finding that there was no waiver of the right to counsel. That I think that the court's decision on that, I guess, can be affirmed or was correct, because at this point there is not a prevailing party because of that mixed decision, and that was this court's holding, and I think it will be able. So we would ask that this court not award attorney's fees to Mrs. Salazar.
Thank you, counsel. Each of you, this matter is now under advisement, and we will render a decision accordingly. We'll now be in recess until 4:30 p.m. this afternoon in Boise.